Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. Our first article is titled, Why Are Flags at Half-Staff in Arizona? Here's What to Know by Shelby Slade and Sarah Lapidus, Arizona Republic. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs ordered that flags across the state fly at half-staff on Monday, June 30th, in honor of the Granite Mountain Hotshots. June 30th marks 12 years since the 19 Arizona firefighters died while fighting the Yarnell Hill Fire. The group of Prescott Hotshots were caught in the blaze's path. We honor the memory and legacy of the 19 Granite Mountain Hotshots who sacrificed their lives to keep Arizonans safe, Hobbs said in a statement. Their bravery and service to our state will always be remembered, and we are holding their families and friends and the entire Prescott community in our thoughts. Here's what to know about the Hotshots, the difference between half-mast and half-staff, and why flags are flown at half-staff. Who were the Granite Mountain Hotshots? What happened to them? The Granite Mountain Hotshots were members of a wildland firefighting crew based out of the Prescott Fire Department. The group had fought several wildfires in 2013 before the Yarnell Hill Fire ignited. In the afternoon of June 30, 2013, the crew communicated over the radio that they were in the black or in burned-over areas near a ridgetop. These areas are safe because they no longer have fuel for the fire to burn. It was assumed the firefighters would stay there. No one realized that the crew left the black-burned area and headed southeast toward another safety zone at Boulder Springs Ranch in the Glen Illa neighborhood of Yarnell. During this time, there was a change in wind direction and speed, causing the fire to spread south three times faster than it had been moving previously and blocking escape routes. The firefighters were trapped and were deploying fire shelters when the fire overtook them. They died in the 2,000-degree heat. The group was found approximately 1 mile south-southeast of their last known location, roughly 600 yards west of the ranch. Some of the firefighters had fully deployed their shelters, while others were found in partially deployed shelters. What is the difference between half-mast and half-staff? Typically, the difference between the two is where the flag is being flown. Half-mast refers to flags flown on ships, while half-staff is used for flags flown on land. When are flags flown at half-staff? There are specific holidays and events when flags are flown at half-staff in the United States. The Arizona State website outlines those days as Memorial Day, when the flag should be displayed at half-staff until noon only, then raised to the top of the staff. Peace Officers Memorial Day, unless that day is also Armed Forces Day. Patriot Day, National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, National Firefighters Memorial Day. U.S. presidents can also declare that flags be flown at half-staff on the death of a notable person, according to the site. In those cases, the flag would be flown at half-staff in these instances: 30 days from the death of the president or a former president, 10 days from the day of death of the vice president, the Chief Justice, or a retired Chief Justice of the United States, or the Speaker of the House of Representatives. From the day of death until the interment of an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, a Secretary of an Executive or Military Department, a former Vice President, or the Governor of a State. The day of death and the following day for a Member of Congress. The governor can also order that the U.S. flag be flown at half-staff on the death of a notable person or former government official or member of the armed forces who dies while on active duty. In Arizona, the governor can also require that the state flag be lowered at all state, institutional, and educational buildings. The law also allows the state flag to be lowered on the death of an incumbent elected state officer for 7 days, beginning on the day following the death of the officer. The next article is titled, New Project to Widen State Route 24 in East Valley, What to Know, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. Those commuting into the Phoenix area from the far southeastern reaches of the valley know the headache of State Route 24. But residents scored a win in the fight against rage-inducing congestion on the only freeway connecting places like Queen Creek and Santan Valley to Phoenix freeways when the Arizona Department of Transportation approved an improvement project in its 5-year plan. Without the approval, planners feared that the bumper-to-bumper traffic on State Route 24 would be diverted to city streets that don't have the capacity to support that many vehicles. The project will widen the 6-mile highway, increasing the number of lanes to 4 between Loop 202 and Williams Field Road, the busiest section of the freeway. Here's what to know. What is the SR 24 improvement project? The project, focused on widening the freeway, will occur on the existing State Route 24, which runs from Ironwood Road in Queen Creek to Loop 202 north of the Mesa Gateway Airport. The improvement project includes increasing the number of general-purpose lanes to 4 lanes in each direction between Loop 202 and Williams Field Road, increasing the number of general-purpose lanes to 3 in each direction between Williams Field Road and Ironwood Drive, bridges over Williams Field, Chrisman, Signal Butte, and Meridian Roads. How many drivers will be affected? SR 24 sees more than 60,000 drivers daily, according to 2023 ADOT data. By 2043, that number is expected to increase by about 20,000. When will SR 24 construction start? Construction will begin in late 2029 or 2030, according to ADOT's 5-year plan. ADOT did not provide an estimated end date. How much will the widening project cost? The project is expected to cost more than $152 million. Are there plans for future expansion? Leaders have floated the idea of extending SR 24 east to US 60 in Pinal County. ADOT said the county will be the lead agency conducting a study to evaluate this extension with support from the department. This extension, though, is not funded, and there is no timeline for when the freeway may be extended east. Our next article is titled, Paraglider Rescued After Crashing in North Phoenix and Getting Stuck in a Power Line, by Roy Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. A paraglider crashed into a power pole in North Phoenix and had to be rescued off a steep hillside, according to the Phoenix Fire Department. At about 6:30 a.m., June 29th, Phoenix firefighters responded to calls of a paraglider who crashed into a power pole and was stuck in a power line near 7th Street and Thunderbird Road, according to Captain Rob McDade. The paraglider, identified only as an adult man, was able to remove himself from his harness and get onto a large rock, McDade said. Rescuers assisted him down the mountain safely and evaluated him. He was not injured and declined to be taken to the hospital, according to McDade. Before the rescue, the paraglider was seen dangling from the middle of a power line and a nearby support beam received substantial damage, photos showed. Arizona Public Service did not report any power outages as a result of the incident. What is a paraglider? A paraglider is a type of aviation device that typically uses a parachute-like canopy to launch a seated pilot into the air, according to the U.S. Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association. Some paragliders are driven by a fan that is powered by a small engine, as was the case in the North Phoenix incident. Do paraglider crashes happen often in Arizona? Paraglider crashes are rare in Arizona, but they do happen. In mid-May, a firefighter recruit in the Prescott area crashed a paraglider and died due to injuries he sustained. Another paraglider crash happened in 2015, also in the Prescott area, which claimed the life of the pilot. In 1993, a 29-year-old man suffered an ankle injury, cuts, and bruises after crashing his paraglider into South Mountain, according to the Arizona Republic Archives. Our next article is titled, Oak Ridge Fire at 1.8K Acres, 0% Containment Near Window Rock in Eastern Arizona, by Perry Vandell, Arizona Republic. A wildfire that ignited near Window Rock remained at 0% containment on the morning of June 29th. The Oak Ridge Fire was reported June 28th, roughly 4 miles south of Summit Road, in the community of St. Michael's, about 10 minutes west of Window Rock, according to a Facebook post from the Navajo Nation Police Department. The fire was reportedly sparked by wood haulers, according to Navajo Nation Police. As of the afternoon of June 29th, the seemingly small fire had burned at least 1,800 acres with 0% containment, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Navajo Region. As of June 29, there were no reports of injuries or deaths. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin posted on Facebook that the evacuation status remained at ready and encouraged residents to remain vigilant regarding the fire's status and to evacuate if possible as a precaution. Nigrin added that the B. Holzel Fighting Scouts Events Center in Fort Defiance is the official evacuation shelter for families, and donations could be dropped off there. Suggested donations include Ziploc bags to distribute dog and cat food, hairbrushes or hair ties, feminine hygiene products such as pads, tampons, and wipes, plates, forks, utensils, bowls, spoons, forks, napkins, cups, gloves, blankets, cots, toiletries such as shampoo, toothbrushes, toothpaste, towels, lotion, soap, and toilet paper, prepared food, snacks, cookies or fruit cups, diapers, wipes, and formula. Nigrin added that the road to Oak Ridge remained closed and urged people to avoid the fire zone, as some had created public safety concerns by doing so. Livestock were being relocated to the Window Rock Fairground, with Navajo Forestry, Fish and Wildlife, and park rangers assisting. So those with livestock who need additional information can call 928-270-8062. The Commission on Emergency Management was scheduled to meet with Nigrin at 11 a.m. and was expected to implement Stage 2 fire restrictions for the Navajo Nation. Next is an article titled, Family of 11 Rescued Off Closed Hiking Trail at South Mountain During Extreme Heat Warning, by Julie Mendez, Arizona Republic. A family of 11 was rescued while hiking the Holbert Trail on South Mountain in Phoenix in the heat of the afternoon on June 29, the Phoenix Fire Department said. The family of 5 adults and 6 children started their hike around 10 a.m. Just before noon, multiple children in the group started complaining about heat and exhaustion and were unable to continue the hike, Captain Rob McDade with the Phoenix Fire Department said. According to the family member who made the 911 call, the children's ages were 3, 5, 9, 10, 11, and 15, McDade said. A tactical rescue crew arrived and made their way up the trail. After making contact with the group, rapid cooling was applied to the hikers, McDade said. The 9-year-old and 11-year-old were put in a big wheel basket to be brought down the base of the mountain, McDade said. Rescuers helped the rest of the family down the trail as well. Medical evaluations were conducted once everyone was down the mountain, but the family refused further treatment or to go to the hospital, McDade said. There were no injuries to any of the rescuers. The family decided to go hiking despite the trail being closed for the day, due to it being an extreme heat day, according to McDade. Several trails on South Mountain were also closed. There were numerous signs posted stating that the trail was closed for hiking activity, McDade said. The high for June 29th was 115 degrees, according to AccuWeather. An extreme heat warning was issued for the Phoenix area through 8 p.m. July 1st, the National Weather Service said. Our next article is titled, Police Identify Two Women Found Shot and Killed in Phoenix Apartment, by Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. Police are investigating the deaths of two women who were found shot inside a Phoenix apartment June 26th. Officers conducting a welfare check discovered Markeisha Williams, 36, and Tywala Spencer, 38, both dead from gunshot wounds, according to Sergeant Brian Bauer, a spokesperson for the Phoenix Police Department. Police say the investigation began after a 911 call came in that morning from someone who reported not hearing from the occupants of the apartment, located near 24th Street and McDowell Road, for several days. Police were granted access to the unit by an employee of the complex, allowing officers to locate the bodies of the two women. Detectives are working closely with the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office to better understand what contributed to this incident, Bauer said in a statement. Bauer declined to share further details, citing an ongoing investigation. Our next article is titled, Scottsdale Quarter Sold, $100 million in upgrades planned. Here's what's coming, by Karina Vanek, Arizona Republic. Luxury retail center Scottsdale Quarter has a new owner, a real estate firm led by tech billionaire with big plans for the shopping center and North Scottsdale. Falcon Eye Ventures, a firm founded by George Kurtz, CEO of CrowdStrike, bought the center, located at Boothroyce Drive and Scottsdale Road, and is planning a $100 million revamp of the high-end shopping destination. Scottsdale Quarter is a powerful asset with even greater future potential as a magnet retail destination and a hub for breakthrough technology companies, Kurtz said in a statement. This acquisition aligns with our commitment to investing in and developing leading mixed-use properties that serve as catalysts for innovative companies and economic growth. Phoenix-based Vestar, the owner and operator of many other Phoenix-area shopping centers, including Desert Ridge Marketplace and Tempe Marketplace, will partner with Falcon Eye and oversee operations of the property. David Larcher, CEO of Vestar, said his company has had a long relationship with Falcon Eye, which owns the Scottsdale Promenade, which Vestar operates. "We brought this opportunity to them near the end of last year," Larcher said of the purchase of Scottsdale Quarter. "We watched the evolution of this project since it was initially developed in the mid-2000s, and we thought this was an opportunity to bring Scottsdale Quarter to the next level." "There is very little vacancy at the shopping center now," Larcher said, "but as tenant leases expire, Vestar will look to replace them with new businesses that will help keep the center fresh and on trend. We want to attract brands and shoppers who see the uniqueness, craftsmanship, and cultural relevance," Larcher said. "We want it to be a fashion-forward destination, similar to the iconic retail streets around the country." Larcher said he would like Scottsdale Quarter to be on the same level as Soho in New York City or the Miami Design District in Miami. "The company will seek out chef-driven restaurants and contemporary luxury retail tenants to fill vacancies as they come up." But Larcher said it will take several years to fully implement the strategy. The $100 million in upgrades will include infrastructure improvements, addressing deferred maintenance, renovations to common areas and landscaping, as well as significant renovations to the office space on the site, like adding a conference center, fitness room, and other amenities, Larcher said. Some of those improvements should begin before the end of the year. The money will also be used to make improvements as new tenants move into the center. Kurtz is also the developer of the nearby Parquet project, which is about a half mile north of Scottsdale Quarter at the site of the shuttered Cracker Jack's theme park. That project, which will cost about $1 billion to develop, was approved by the Scottsdale City Council in 2023. The first phase has been submitted to the city for development review and is planned to include 4 restaurant buildings, a 70-unit condominium development, and an 89-unit mixed-use apartment building. At full build-out, the site will have about 2 million square feet of buildings. In total, the site will have about 897 apartment units, 98 workforce housing units, 115 traditional condo units, and 126 condo units that will be branded with a 5-star hotel. Plans also call for a 223-room 5-star hotel and 100,000 square feet of office space. Next is an article about Tempe. It's titled, In the East Valley, New Projects Coming in Tempe, Chandler, Scottsdale, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. East Valley residents can look forward to a 7-story apartment building, hotel expansion, and medical campus, all opening within 2 years. Parcel 3G, an apartment complex near University Drive and Rural Road in Tempe, is the third multifamily project within the Novus Innovation Corridor, a 300-acre mix of offices, apartments, sports facilities, and a hotel. The Hilton Garden Inn, in the heart of downtown Chandler, is adding over 5,000 square feet and will open by the end of the year. A comprehensive medical campus in North Scottsdale will be home to Banner Health Center Plus, which will house a wide range of services. Here's what to know about the projects. Parcel 3G near Arizona State University in Tempe. A 333-unit apartment complex located just east of ASU's campus has been under construction on a 2.4-acre site since 2022. The complex will include a resort-style pool and clubhouse, work and lounge areas, a fitness center, and more. According to records, some of the units must be considered attainable housing. Residents will be welcomed in January 2026. Hilton Garden Inn in downtown Chandler. The four-story hotel is expanding its footprint with an extension adding 68 rooms, additional conference space, and other amenities. The expansion is being developed by Phoenix-based company HCW. The project includes a first-floor breezeway for pedestrian access to the adjacent parking garage, as well as meeting and event space, an outdoor event patio, and bridal suite. The Hilton Garden Inn on Chicago Street and Arizona Avenue is still in operation during construction. The expansion will open in late 2025. Banner Health Medical Campus in North Scottsdale. An ambulatory surgery center, a pharmacy, and imaging space will be part of a 120,000-square-foot medical building near Loop 101 and Mayo Boulevard. Also on the campus will be a Banner Urgent Care, which will be open 365 days a year with extended hours, as well as a Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center. Developers broke ground on the campus on May 21st. The project's first phase of construction is expected to be completed in early 2027. The next article is titled, 13-year-old Arizona girl killed after off-road vehicle lands on her during crash, by Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. A teenage girl is dead after an off-road crash in northwestern Arizona on June 25th, marking at least the sixth victim of side-by-side vehicle crashes on rural roads in 2025. Just before 8 p.m., deputies responded to calls of a crash on a private property in Cane Beds, a community just south of the Arizona-Utah border near Colorado City. Deputies found an unidentified 13-year-old girl who was pronounced dead at the scene by firefighters, according to the Mojave County Sheriff's Office. Deputies learned two underage girls were driving a side-by-side style off-road vehicle in a dirt field. At one point, the driver started doing donuts as the passenger was hanging out of the vehicle. The driver reportedly turned sharply, which caused the vehicle to overturn and land on the passenger, the sheriff's office said in a news release. Deputies said the underage driver attempted unsuccessfully to lift the vehicle off the victim and then ran about a quarter mile for help due to a lack of cell phone service. It did not appear either of the occupants used safety equipment, according to the sheriff's office. The Mojave County Attorney's Office will review any charges, but the investigation remains ongoing. How many Arizona off-roaders died in 2025? The 13-year-old death happened after a series of other fatal crashes that involved off-road side-by-side style vehicles. On June 22nd, Miguel A. Pacheco was reported to have crashed a vehicle in northern Arizona with three underage people on board, which resulted in his grandchild, an unrestrained 19-month-old child, being ejected and killed. A 17- and 7-year-old were also injured. Other crashes occurred in mid-April, when two girls, ages 4 and 10, died in Lower Eagle Creek in Greenlee County when a rollover crash after a family trip ended in their vehicle being completely submerged in water. In early February, two teenagers died after their side-by-side vehicle was in a collision and fell several feet down an embankment in the area of 47th Avenue and Chola Street in Phoenix. The teens were identified as Nolan Coughlin, 16, and Hunter Strode, 18. A side-by-side vehicle is an off-road vehicle with an open-air cabin and seating for at least the driver and passenger next to each other. They are sometimes simply called a Razor or a Polaris, both of which are popular manufacturers of the vehicles alongside dozens of other brands. The vehicles traced their roots to military jeeps and dune buggy-like vehicles used to navigate difficult terrain, with modern commercial options featuring models used for exploring trails as much as working on the farm, according to Super ATV. Is it legal to ride an off-road vehicle without a helmet? State law said helmets were required for underage operators and passengers of off-road vehicles, including side-by-side styles, all-terrain vehicles, and motorcycles, according to Arizona State Parks. It was recommended by state agencies, but not required, for adults to wear a helmet. Starting in late 2024, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs signed a law requiring at least one owner of an off-road vehicle to take an online safety course in order to operate in Arizona. The next article is titled, Evacuations Underway for Navajo Community Members Living Near Oak Ridge Fire, by Alyssa D. Vicente, Arizona Republic. Evacuations were ordered for people living in the Navajo communities of Hunters Point and Oak Springs area late on June 29 as the Oak Ridge Fire ravaged the area for the second night, burning over 6,292 acres and having no containment. On the morning of June 30th, the BIA Complex Incident Management Team, a coordinated group of federal and state wildfire agencies, assumed command of the Oak Ridge Fire and the Incident Command Center. They confirmed the fire grew to 6,292 acres from 1,800 the previous day. The Oak Ridge Fire, which Navajo Nation police say was sparked by wood haulers on June 28, quickly grew in size, threatening nearby homes, utility lines, and gas infrastructure. During a June 29th evening briefing, Rex Kontz, Deputy General Manager of the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, informed officials that a 115 kV power line running through the fire zone had to be shut down. He said Navajo communities including Burnside, Clagato, Chinle, and Ganado are being powered through rerouted sources, which has created additional challenges for maintaining stable electricity. NTUA, the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, is the only utility company that services a majority, if not all, of the Navajo Nation. We are asking everyone to conserve power, Kontz warned, adding the backup power source is at risk of overloading. If that happens, power to non-essential business services may need to be shut off until fire is under control. What we are worried about is, it's summertime, and air conditioners use a lot of power. Since the fire began, a major concern has been the safety of the El Paso Natural Gas Plant, located near the evacuated communities of Hunters Point and Oak Springs. In his latest update, Navajo Nation President Boo Nygren stated that in Oak Springs, the GO evacuation order applies to residents living west of mile marker 12 on Navajo Route 12 up to the El Paso gas station. Residents north of the station remain in a set evacuation status. There is significant danger in this area, and residents need to begin relocating to a shelter or with family and friends outside the affected zone, Nygren stated. Governor Katie Hobbs said on social media that her administration was actively monitoring the Oak Ridge Fire. We are in communication with both Apache County and Navajo Nation and will work with them to keep Arizonans safe, Hobbs posted on X.com, formerly Twitter. I'm thankful to the first responders on the ground, and am keeping the entire community in my thoughts as they work to combat the fire. Navajo Nation orders Stage 2 fire restrictions. On the second day of the fire, the Commission on Emergency Management declared a state of emergency due to the Oak Ridge Fire, requesting additional Navajo Nation resources to address both current and potential wildfire impacts. Fire restrictions were also increased from Stage 1 to Stage 2, with Nygren signing off on the declarations. Stage 2 fire restrictions prohibit all open flames, including campfires and charcoal use, even in designated recreation areas. Smoking is only allowed inside enclosed vehicles or buildings. The use of firearms, air rifles, and exploding targets is banned outside of lawful hunting. Additionally, under Stage 2 fire restrictions, operating chainsaws or other internal combustion engines between 10 a.m. and 8 p.m., as well as welding or using open flame torches, is strictly prohibited. During the briefing, the Apache County Sheriff's Office stated that if deputies or officers spot anyone transporting wood during these restricted hours, they are authorized to stop the individual, seize the wood, and deliver it to the St. Michael's Chapter House for distribution to elders during the winter. The state of emergency addresses the severity of the Oak Ridge fire, ongoing regional drought conditions, and the existing Navajo Nation fire restriction. According to the declaration, Navajo Nation will activate available emergency resources, including funding for personnel, equipment, and other necessary to support to restore and sustain critical community infrastructure. All Navajo Nation divisions, departments, programs, and chapters are directed to initiate emergency response coordination, allocate resources, and implement response measures in collaboration with federal, state, and tribal partners to meet the needs of affected communities. The Commission on Emergency Management, in unified coordination with our nation's emergency response agencies and local leadership, has declared this emergency to prioritize the safety and well-being of our communities impacted by the Oak Ridge fire. This declaration enables critical resources and operational support to be activated immediately, said CEM Chair Marcolo Roanhorse. We express deep appreciation to the firefighters, law enforcement, emergency personnel, and volunteers working on the front lines. As a commission, we stand ready to support our nation through this challenging time with diligence, compassion, and an unwavering commitment to public safety. Evacuation shelter designated, donations requested. For the past 2 days, the official evacuation shelter was available at the B. Hallsdill, meaning stronghold, Fighting Scouts Events Center in Fort Defiance, home to Window Rock High School and Sehutsi Medical Center. As of noon on June 29th, 15 families were staying at the shelter. It remains unclear how many more sought refuge there after evacuation orders were elevated to go later that evening. The event center is also serving as a donation drop-off site. Items requested during the briefing including children's pull-ups, sizes 4T and 5T, kids' shoes, sizes 8, 10, 11, men's shirts, extra large and 2X, pillows, baby wipes, toiletries, personal hygiene products, towels, non-perishable food items, and washcloths. Also requested were clean kennels. Another concern was the safety of animals and pets. To help the Division of Dene Education in Window Rock offered space for evacuees to stay with their pets, but some individuals chose to remain in their vehicles with their animals rather than shelter inside the events center. Animal control will also be housed there in the facility, and free vaccination for cats and dogs will be provided for evacuees' pets. The owner and pet must remain on site. Cots and dog and cat food are available. Navajo Nation Council Delegate Dr. Andy Nez, who represents the communities of Fort Defiance, Sawmill, Crystal, and Red Lake, said during the briefing that he was contacted by veterinarians who volunteered to assist evacuees' pets experiencing smoke inhalation and other related health issues, and they are located at the Division of Dene Education. Nygren urged the public to be cautious of GoFundMe pages claiming to raise money for the fire, noting that the Navajo Nation does not have an official fundraiser for it. The call center for services and information related to the Oak Ridge fire is 505-422-7382. The Navajo Nation Fairgrounds is available for evacuated livestock. Contact 928-270-8062 or 928-270-2254 to coordinate drop-off. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue with the news. Our next article is titled, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays Calls for Testing of Lead and Heavy Metals in Baby Food, by Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays called on federal health authorities to establish guidelines that would prevent lead and heavy metal poisoning from contaminating baby products. On June 26, Mays issued a letter asking the United States Food and Drug Administration and Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to reconsider a petition issued by 20 attorneys general across the country urging for stricter oversight and testing. Mays saw the possible contamination as a credible threat to the health and safety of Arizona babies after numerous nationwide recent recalls, including at major grocers like Target. The FDA's delay in acting on the state's petition to protect them and avoid these senseless food recalls is inexcusable. It's past time for the FDA to act, Mays wrote in a statement. Mays cited a Target recall of Good and Gather vegetable puree in April and in October 2023 for Wanabana applesauce, both for elevated levels of lead. Had FDA used the authority they have to issue guidance on finished product testing years ago, as requested by my state attorney general colleagues, these recalls and lead poisonings might have been avoided, wrote Mays. Mays co-signed the letter to the FDA alongside District of Columbia Attorney General Brian Schwab. The other 20 attorney generals that were part of the original petition were from Connecticut, Colorado, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Nevada, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Vermont, Washington, and Wisconsin, according to a news release from Mays' office. Mays warned that lead and heavy metal exposure was a real danger to growing child's health and development because parents rely on baby and toddler foods available at local grocers. Mays believed this risk could be reduced if food manufacturers did proper testing on finished products. The next article is titled, After Years, Dangerous Metro Phoenix Highway Okayed for Improvements, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. Car crashes are frequent on State Route 347, one nearly every day. They pray to get to their jobs, and they pray to get home to their families, said Rich Vitiello, a Pinal County District Supervisor, at an Arizona State Transportation Board meeting June 20th. He said he has pleaded with the board for about 20 years to pour resources into the dangerous and deadly 30-mile highway. He's not alone. Residents along the highway have been pushing for roadway improvements for decades, which has deteriorated as the region developed quickly. But despite its danger, SR 347 is a necessary lifeline to the Phoenix area for those living in the city of Maricopa, which lies in Pinal County, south of the Gila River Indian Community, and is one of the fastest-growing cities in the nation. The Arizona Department of Transportation is seeking to do something about that danger. It authorized a widening project on the Pinal County portion of the freeway, a victory for residents and community leaders in decades-long battle for funding. Where is SR 347? State Route 347 connects Interstate 10 southwest of Chandler to State Route 84 in Pinal County. It serves as the main line to the Phoenix area from Maricopa and cuts through the Gila River Indian Community. The freeway between Maricopa and Riggs Road, a section that lies in Pinal County, has seen a nearly 30% increase in the number of daily drivers in the past decade, according to ADOT data. Now, the freeway supports upwards of 50,000 daily drivers, and almost 80% of Maricopa's population commutes to the valley for work, school, or other activities, said Maricopa Mayor Nancy Smith. Congestion and near daily car crashes are only expected to get worse as the population booms, making the SR 347 widening project proposed in ADOT's five-year plan a necessity in the eyes of Maricopa residents and the City Council. What is the widening project? The 7.3-mile widening project approved in the five-year plan runs between the City of Maricopa and Riggs Road. The project is expected to cost more than $137 million. ADOT's plan does not include work north of Riggs Road, which is part of Maricopa County. Work on the northern stretch of SR 347 is part of Maricopa County's transportation plan. The project broadly aims to enhance safety, reduce congestion, and support future growth. Elements include widening the freeway in one lane in each direction, widening existing bridges at Santa Rosa Wash, Santa Cruz Wash, and Gila River. intersection improvements and modifications to accommodate a six-lane highway and improve safety and traffic flow. How was the project funded? Maricopa had their own skin in the game. Part of the funding will come from the state, and Pinal County will contribute about $20 million to the $137 million price tag, according to Vitiello. But $50 million will come from the residents of Maricopa themselves. In a push for transportation funding, namely SR 347, the very conservative city council approved a half-cent sales tax in May, something that has never been done in the city before, Smith said. The city noted that residents have supported actions like this in the past, with Proposition 417, a voter-approved half-cent tax, and Proposition 469, a ballot measure that proposed over $1 billion in funding for countywide transportation projects. Prop 417, passed in 2017, was struck down by the Arizona Supreme Court in 2022, and no transportation projects were funded as a result. Proposition 469 was put on the 2022 ballot, but failed in Pinal County despite Maricopa voters' support. "We've had our own skin in the game," Smith said. What about the section of SR 347 in Maricopa County? Improvements to the section of SR 347 north of Riggs Road are planned for 2031 in the Maricopa Association of Governments Transportation Plan. The four-mile stretch from Riggs Road to I-10 is not funded by ADOT. Instead, the Maricopa County Widening Project is funded by Proposition 479, a half-cent sales tax Maricopa County residents approved in 2024, aimed at supporting transportation projects. In its plan, MAG set aside $90 million to widen the freeway. When will construction be done? An official timeline and end date have not been announced by ADOT, but construction will be completed in phases, with the work on the Pinal County section expected to begin in late 2026 or 2027. Widening the Maricopa County section is expected to begin in Phase 2 of MAG's transportation plan from fiscal year 2031 to 2035. We move on now to USA Today. The first article is titled, "Sniper Suspect Identified in Idaho Firefighter Ambush, Live Updates," by John Bacon, Michael Loria, Christopher Kahn, Nadia Yancey Bragg, and Carissa Waddick, USA Today. A firefighter was fighting for his life Monday while authorities in Idaho were trying to determine why a sniper ignited a blaze before ambushing and fatally shooting two responding firefighters. The sniper was found dead following a shootout with police, Kootenai County Sheriff Bob Norris said. The wounded firefighter was in stable condition late Sunday, Norris said. The sniper was identified as 20-year-old Wes Rowley, a law enforcement official confirmed to USA Today. Norris said law enforcement received a 911 call Sunday afternoon about a brush fire and were notified a short time later that firefighters were taking gunfire. Officers locked down nearby neighborhoods and hunted for the shooter in hilly terrain covered with thick brush while smoke billowed from the growing fire. Officers exchanged gunfire with the shooter, Norris said. The discovery of the shooter's body on Canfield Mountain, a popular hiking destination outside the city of Kotor Dalin, culminated 6 hours of chaos that saw about 300 local, state, and federal officers flock to the area. This was a total ambush, Norris said at a briefing late Sunday. These firefighters did not have a chance. One of the slain firefighters worked at Kootenai County Fire and Rescue, and the other worked for the Coeur d'Alene Fire Department. The wounded firefighter also works for the Coeur d'Alene Department. Idaho Governor orders flags to fly at half-staff. Idaho Governor Brad Little ordered flags in the state to fly at half-staff to honor the firefighters killed and injured in the ambush. The flags will stay lowered until the day after the firefighters' memorial service, which has yet to be determined, according to the governor's order. The entire state of Idaho grieves the profound loss of the firefighters killed in the shocking ambush in North Idaho, Little said in a statement. This indescribable loss is felt deeply by all those in the firefighting community and beyond. Firefighter to dispatch, "I am pinned down." A call to dispatch from a firefighter who says there are two battalion chiefs down reflected the unfolding terror. "Right now, there's an active shooter zone. Everybody's shot up here. the voice says in the dispatch, recording obtained IdahoNews.com and other outlets. We need law enforcement up here immediately. He adds that we could possibly get the two wounded out. I am pinned down behind Battalion 1's rig. It is clear to me that the fire was set intentionally to draw us in. Residents on edge after shooting. The shooting was a shock to residents of Coeur d'Alene, including Linda Tiger, 80, who told the BBC she has lived in the city for nearly three decades. This has never happened here, Tiger said. Brian Hadley told the New York Times he was training for a mountain bike race near Canfield Mountain when he learned about the fire. Hadley told the outlet he heard three gunshots as he rode back down the mountain. It's heartbreaking, he said. Bruce Deming helped direct law enforcement to a trail near his property that leads to the area where the fire was set, the Associated Press reported. I just don't want to have to wake up in the middle of the night to figure if somebody's out prowling around my place, he said. Governor Little, heinous direct assault. Authorities found the shooter's body and a nearby firearm using cell phone location data, Norris said. It's unclear how the suspect died, but Norris said law enforcement responding to the shooting had exchanged gunfire with him. Governor Brad Little said he and his wife, Therese, were heartbroken. Multiple heroic firefighters were attacked today while responding to a fire in North Idaho. Little said in a social media post, This is a heinous, direct assault on our brave firefighters. I ask all Idahoans to pray for them and their families as we wait to learn more. Shooting occurred in popular destination for hikers, bikers. The shooter's body was discovered on Canfield Mountain, a forested area that is popular destination for hikers and mountain bikers. Canfield Mountain Natural Area is a 24-acre open space park that has trails rated intermediate in difficulty and a few advanced areas, according to the city of Coeur d'Alene. There are more than 25 miles of trails in the area, according to a Forest Service fact sheet. Some trails are steep and have ruts, rocks, roots, or other obstacles, the Forest Service said. Others have loose rock or steep drop-offs along the edge. Fire grew during shutout, manhunt. Idaho Department of Land's fire crews were unable to access the fire, named the Nettleton Gulch Fire, until it was deemed safe, about 6 hours after it ignited, the department said in a statement late Sunday. Crews estimated that it grew to about 15 to 20 acres, with numerous snags and steep terrain. Resources including aircraft, heavy equipment, water tenders, engines, and hand crews were being brought in, the statement said. Timeline of the Canfield Mountain attack. At 1:21 p.m. local time, emergency dispatchers received a phone call reporting a fire on the east side of Canfield Mountain, Norris said. The caller did not reveal his name and is not believed to be the gunman. Firefighters arrived at the scene, and at 2 p.m., firefighters broadcast that there were shots fired. Hundreds of law enforcement agents responded to the scene of the shooting. Officers exchanged gunfire with the suspect, Norris said. Investigators used cell phone location data and discovered a signal on Canfield Mountain that had not moved since 3:16 p.m. Authorities honed in on the location and discovered the man who they believed to be the suspect. Just after 7:40 p.m., the Kootenai Sheriff's Office announced that a man had been found dead and lifted the shelter-in-place order. Where is Coeur d'Alene? The attack on the firefighters happened outside Coeur d'Alene, a northwest Idaho city about 250 miles east of Seattle and 30 miles east of Spokane, Washington. U.S. Census data estimates it has a population of over 57,000. It is located in Kootenai County, an area north of the Coeur d'Alene Native American Reservation. Kootenai borders Washington State and has a population of over 188,000, according to the latest census estimates. Next is an article titled, P. Diddy Trial Live Updates. Jurors Begin Deliberations in Sean Combs' Sweeping Sex Crimes Case, by Patrick Ryan, Aisha Bagchi, and Edward Segarra, USA Today. Sean Diddy Combs' fate is in the hands of 12 jurors as they deliberate a verdict in the embattled hip-hop mogul's criminal trial. The jury, which has heard graphic testimony on Combs' alleged abuses from more than 30 witnesses, gathered again in Manhattan court on June 30th, following the completion of closing arguments from Combs' attorneys. The rapper's lawyer, Mark Agnifilo, framed the case as a tale of two trials. He argued the case is about love, jealousy, and money, not trafficking or racketeering. He accused the government of putting on a show to target a wealthy celebrity. Agnifilo claimed prosecutors distorted the Grammy-winning rapper's consensual sexual lifestyle into criminal acts, while witnesses spoke of the successful black entrepreneur as a respected and generous figure. Meanwhile, Prosecutor Maureen Comey returned to the floor to present the government's rebuttal, focusing on previous remarks on Combs' former girlfriend, Cassandra Cassie Ventura Fine. Mr. Agnifilo suggested Cassie was the winner of a prize. Black eyes? A gash in her head? Getting urinated in her mouth? How could anyone think that's a prize? That's ridiculous. Combs, 55, was arrested in September and charged with sex trafficking, racketeering, and transportation to engage in prostitution. He has pleaded not guilty. Could Diddy go to prison? Yes. If convicted on the racketeering charge, Combs could face life in prison. While the statutory minimum sentence for sex trafficking is 15 years, and for transportation to engage in prostitution is a maximum of 10 years. A mixed verdict, convicted on some but not all charges, could add up to any number of years. Judge in Diddy case outlines racketeering. The longest section of instructions given to jurors centered around Combs' first charge, racketeering. Judge Arun Subrahmanyan went through the 8 accusations included in the charge, which fall under the umbrella of kidnapping, arson, bribery, possession with intent to distribute narcotics, sex trafficking, witness tampering, forced labor, and transportation for the purpose of prostitution. In order to find Combs guilty, the jury must believe he committed 2 of the 8 crimes, Subrahmanyan said. While he explained the drug element of count 1, he listed off multiple types of drugs, including methamphetamine, oxycodone, and ketamine, before pausing and saying, "This long word that you see here," which drew laughs from the courtroom. Judge explains sex trafficking, prostitution charges. For Combs' sex trafficking charge, Subrahmanyan said the jury would need to find that there was a threat of psychological, financial, or reputational harm against the rapper's alleged victims. The judge defined a commercial sex act as something given in exchange for the sexual act. That doesn't always have to be money, he clarified, and it can be an object or a thing. The sex act doesn't need to have actually happened, as long as the intent was clear and there was an exchange of money or other perks. Diddy stares down jurors as they receive instructions. Combs' sex crimes trial is now in the hands of 12 jurors as they kick off their deliberations. There is no time frame for their process, and any verdict must be unanimous. You can see it's long, but I'm going to try to make it interesting while I'm reading it, Subrahmanyan said before launching into instructions for the panel. He explained that if they believe Combs is guilty of his charges, it must be beyond a reasonable doubt. Combs could be seen putting on glasses and looking directly at the jury box as they received instructions. He leaned back in his chair, legs crossed. Combs' family was seated in the front row, and his daughters could be seen whispering to each other. After marathon Diddy trial, judge thanks jurors and lawyers. Before the jury started deliberations, Subrahmanyan dismissed the 6 alternate jurors who have attended the trial daily, just in case a juror had to bow out or be removed from the proceedings. The judge thanked the alternate jurors, adding that they would get his personal phone number if you have any questions, if you would like a tour of the courthouse, anything I can do. Subrahmanyan also thanked attorneys on both sides. The case was really exceptionally tried, he said, thanking both the prosecutorial and defense teams for letting younger lawyers take on substantial parts of the case. It's vital to the profession, he said. While the jury deliberates, Combs will remain in jail. He had a request for books he could bring with him, though the specific works weren't released publicly. Diddy trial jury can't watch news, research case online. Subrahmanyan reiterated that jurors cannot conduct any independent research, including going online or watching the news while they're deliberating. The jurors should not judge Combs for deciding not to testify, he added. Remember at all times, you are not partisans, You are judges of the fact, Subramanian said. The jury was dismissed to deliberate at 11:30 a.m. There was a brief objection from prosecutors about evidence provided to the jury, specifically some BlackBerry messages that they said had leading subject lines. That included one that read, "I am so horny I can't concentrate," and others about Combs doing whatever he wanted sexually. The judge agreed that all the subject lines in the evidence should be neutral. What happens next? Subramanian began delivering legal instructions to the jury in Manhattan Federal Court on June 30th. Once the judge finishes, the 12-member jury will begin deliberating. What is Diddy's net worth? Still wealthy, but now worth about half as much, Forbes. In 2024, Forbes magazine estimated Combs' net worth at $400 million, a significant drop from the 2019 figure of $740 million. Both Combs and his team later claimed he was a billionaire, Forbes said, despite offering no documentation to back up the claim. According to publicly available documents and news reports, Combs' most valuable personal possession is likely his 17,000-square-foot, 10-bedroom mansion, appraised at more than $61 million in the Tony Holmby Hills section of Los Angeles. It was raided as part of a criminal probe and listed for sale last September. Diddy's lawyer encourages jurors to return him to his family. Appealing to jurors as Combs' peers and praising the country's due process, Agnifilo told the jury on June 27th, "Today, you guys are the United States of America. This is your house. I'm asking you to acquit Sean Combs." He added that Combs sits there innocent. Return him to his family, who have been waiting for him. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.